The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The jobs market is heating up. The Labor Department said Friday the U.S. economy added 850,000 jobs last month. That's a sharp acceleration in growth from May, and a lot higher than economists had forecast.
It's a mixed report. For every positive thing you point to, there's something less positive. You point to job created, but the labor force participation and employment to population stayed down. Higher wages, but hours worked went down, which means that the Fed will look at this and say it confirms a wait and see approach. And I think that's why the equity markets responded the way they responded.
Life-threatening heat continues to bear down on both coasts, and the death toll is rising. The high temperatures in the Pacific Northwest are beginning to move inland. Throughout the heat wave, Washington State reported more than 1,300 emergency room visits for heat-related illnesses. The town of Lytton, British Columbia, hit a record 121 degrees.
Tesla Model S Plaid burst into flames earlier this week while the owner was driving it, just 3 days after delivery. The driver's attorney says the driver was initially not able to get out of the car as the locks malfunctioned, and he had to force his way through the door to escape.
Home prices shattering records. According to the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller U.S. Index, home prices in 20 U.S. cities jumped almost 15% from April 2020 to 2021, the biggest yearly gain since 1988.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The end of the first half of 2021 is behind us. Economies continue to reopen, and the news articles are numerous, with employees and employers discussing what a return back to the office full-time or what the hybrid schedule looks like versus working from home entirely. In the markets this week, because of the month end, some of the performance this week in sectors, groups, and themes were clouded by repositioning and rebalancing. There were periods where interest rates fell and growth in tech outperformed, while in other days, value and cyclical stocks outperformed. There weren't any other major themes that drove the market in one direction, but inflation continues to be a theme despite calls from central bankers. It's a transitory theme. Now, the ECB's President Lagarde sees recovery in the economy, and she thinks inflation will stabilize below their inflationary target. But the ECB member Weidman suggests the ECB should not allow any inflationary overshoot. And Friday, the Eurozone showed a 1.3% increase month over month in producer prices, and that's 9.6% year-over-year. Quite high. On that note, OPEC met and agreed to set production at 400,000 barrels per day versus 500,000 expected, which caused West Texas Intermediate futures to top $75 per barrel on Thursday. And we have often looked at oil as a leading indicator on inflation, so obviously with this increase in supply, there's still quite a bit of cuts that have been in place for the pandemic and earlier. We'll just have to see what OPEC decides at the next meeting. But so far, the trend is higher for oil. We also got key economic announcements this week, which usually hit at the beginning of the month, indicating that manufacturing is strong, prices are high, and jobs are plentiful, but the workers are few. The ISM Manufacturing Index dropped slightly to 60.6 from 61.2% in May, but the factors support the three themes I mentioned of strength, high prices, and not enough workers. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index was announced this week. It reported a large jump for June, up to 127 from 120, which showed robust spending activity expected in the short term and highlighted an increase in consumer plans to buy homes, automobiles, and major appliances despite high prices and inflation, which I thought was a very positive sign that prices, while relatively high, aren't high enough to curb consumer intentions. Vacation intentions also rose, so very clear economic data that reopening continues in force and consumption is strong. While still on this point of higher prices, it's interesting to note that lumber futures have dropped as suppliers have taken advantage of high prices to bring supply to the market. Prices have dropped significantly. Back on May 10th, per 1,000 board feet, prices were at $1,711. And recently on July 1st, $737. For some reference, prices were at $435 per 1,000 board feet a year ago. Initial claims dropped to a new post-COVID low of 364,000, but continuing claims are still very high and actually went up for the previous week, up about 56,000 to 3.46 million. The reports for June, the payroll, the non-farm payroll, showed that there was growth, but it missed in other areas. Non-farm payrolls increased 850,000, above consensus for 680,000. The unemployment rate at 5.9%, average hourly earnings up 0.3%, and the average work week all missed expectations. And much higher unemployment has been seen for minority groups, which, as Chairman Powell has been very concerned of the uneven recovery in the economy. The overall conclusion by investors' reaction on Friday was that it was a good report, but also supports the reasons the Fed has to keep accommodation steady. Traders bought the 10-year Treasury, driving yields lower, which since March has continued to support growth and tech stocks. Finally, factory orders were up in May by 1.7% after briefly dipping in April after a long streak indicating it was a normal reprieve, and activity is recovering nicely still. Financial stocks were mostly flat this week after having a nice bounce in the last week. The stress tests announced by the Fed were a key component last week in that recovery and obviously bouncing back from the dip from the previous 2 weeks. And this week, the Fed announced additional restrictions on dividends and buybacks put in place during the pandemic ended on June 30th. All 23 large banks showed they are holding well above their risk-based minimum capital requirements. Morgan Stanley doubled their dividend and increased its share buyback to $12 billion, and Goldman increased its dividend to $2 a share from $1.25. Other increases in dividends were found in many other banks, while Citigroup left its dividend the same, but possibly because it's been there for quite some time. In fact, before the pandemic, since August 2019 is where Citigroup has left its dividend. The financial sector ETF XLF is up 26% this year due to rising rates, improvement in the economy, and now with some approval from the Fed to ease restrictions on the buybacks and dividends. It's been a good trade. The question now is where will interest rates go and how will earnings season go, with some of the financials having warned of lower trading revenue in the second quarter. And before I forget, there was some interesting news from Johnson & Johnson Friday that said its COVID-19 vaccine showed persistent activity against the Delta variant of COVID with long-lasting durability of response. I'm not sure how that translates to a non-scientist, but the Delta variant has been surfacing in some of the trading news I've been reading all week over concerns of more lockdowns, possibly. So this was welcome news, and also we did see some outperformance in the U.S., who's thought of as having a lot more vaccine distribution versus developed and emerging markets as a result of those concerns on that Delta variant. Now, the earnings season is around the corner, and we'll kick off on Tuesday the 13th in a couple of weeks with the banks. But until then, enjoy a happy 4th of July weekend ahead with U.S. markets closed on Monday to observe.
The well-known geopolitical strategist and author Peter Zeihan joined FS Insider this week to build on the topic of slowing population growth and why this is a pretty big deal. Peter says that one of the major problems is that economic models across the globe and the financial system as a whole is predicated on constant growth. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners this week on FS Insider.
The underlying idea is that everything we know about economic theory is based on the concept of expansion. So ever since the Columbus expeditions, we've been knitting the world together into a bigger and bigger whole and having more trade and more interaction and more financial penetration and more capacity and more industrial expansion and more consumption, more. But at the root of all of that is population growth. Ever since roughly 1500, the global population has gotten bigger each and every year right up until now. We've reached a tipping point.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Is your portfolio prepared for higher inflation? Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Another good week for stock investors as the S&P and the NASDAQ hit to new records, but the Dow seems to lag. Let's find out what is causing this. Joining me on the program is Financial Sense's Frank Barbera. Frank, let's take it from the top. If we take a look at the way the markets developed this year, at the beginning of the year, we saw the NASDAQ, the FANG stocks taking off, and then a couple months into the year, there was a rotational shift into cyclicals, Dow-type stocks. Now it seems back to the NASDAQ setting records, the S&P, the Dow is lagging, but also the transports, and on top of that, bond yields are falling. So which is the real story here?
Well, I think it has been, first of all, this rotation has been very positive, Jim, for the markets. So it's been acting in a way where it's one group has sort of cooled off, taken a breather. The other groups have come on and started to pick up. And so it's been really a wonderful high wire act for the major averages where the rotation has been a big positive. I think of late, what I'm seeing is we saw the deep cyclicals, a lot of the metals related stocks starting to struggle about 2 weeks ago, and they've come off the highs. But they had a very, very strong performance in the first half of the year. So I guess that's not really something to be too alarmed about, maybe somewhat predictable. And we're starting to see rotation. We've seen rotation to REITs, consumer staples, which were really down. About 2 weeks ago, consumer staples couldn't find a bid. And they've come on rather nicely over the last week or two. Utilities look like they're starting to turn up. So what I see is a rotation in healthcare, which had been long overlooked for most of the first half of the year, has come out of the gate very, very strong. I think there's some latent concern about the Delta variant, which is driving healthcare as well, and that's still making new highs today. So there's been a bit of a defensive shift of late. And that probably has a little bit to do also with the fact that we've seen commodity prices more or less plateau. They had been skyrocketing, and now they've kind of stepped back a notch or two. They come off the highs. Most of them are in ranges, trading ranges. You look at the grains like soybeans, wheat, corn. They had a pretty significant sell-off. And then since then, they've been in a high level range. They're not actually that far off their highs, but a lot of back and forth behavior. And in the case of the metals, some of the metals have come down off the highs. You've seen a big sell off in gold, something of a decent sized sell off in copper and silver. And so that's taken a little starch out in the short term. I think that's what's been driving the rotation. The tech had a big pause, and now it's acting very well. I see a lot of names within technology that look like they're trying to break out topside. So again, the leadership just continues to rotate, and actually it's all very, very positive. I'm putting out a mid-year piece today called the U.S. Stock Market, Still Going Strong. And when you look inside the advanced decline line, which I maintain, it's a little bit different than what's widely quoted. But basically, the market internals are still quite robust. We've seen a little bit of this rotational correction in the last few weeks. But believe it or not, in a pretty short order, the market's already making its way back towards neutral to slightly oversold readings. So this is a market that, if we actually had a 2-3% pullback in prices, it would probably put enough fuel in the tank to push it even higher. And I think that's the path of least resistance, is higher for equity prices.
And Frank, let's switch over to commodities for a minute, because if you look at probably going back to 2008 when energy prices peaked, I mean, it's been a terrible decade for energy prices beginning in 2014. Until recently. But when you looked at the commodity complex last year, it was copper, it was silver, it was gold. Likewise, the beginning of the year, energy kind of lagged. Now it seems like everything just flipped out of that. And energy, we're talking on the day you and I are speaking, which is a Thursday, we've got oil prices at $75 a barrel.
That's right. And the commodity the commodities complex, you know, I think we're going to see the same sort of rotation take place there. So I think when you look at, for example, oil prices, very, very short term, crude oil, the West Texas Intermediate, first of all, at 75, it's coming right back up against the October 4th, 2018 highs, which were a print just over $75. So there's some strong resistance here on crude oil. It is a little bit of a negative divergence developing. Brent crude is not making new highs right now with nearby West Texas Intermediate. And also momentum indicators are starting to fail in here short term. So I think oil might be getting set up for a consolidation. And I could see crude oil WTI backing off towards $70 in the short term and maybe setting up a range between 70 and 75 over the next few weeks. That's if it has a hard time with the resistance at 75. 75 is an important level on crude. If it can push through that near term and keep moving, and especially if we see Brent prices start to move up and confirm the highs, new highs in West Texas Intermediate, then that would be kind of an all clear, and you could actually start moving towards $80, $85 in oil. Obviously, that will continue to put upward price pressure on at the pump, where gasoline prices are, you know, are really robust and pushing $5 a gallon in many, many places. So I think the energy complex, to me, it looks like it could take a little breather here for a while. Gold and silver already did. And actually, they've come down so much in such a short period of time. I think they're a couple of days away from a trading low. So that group, the precious metals, we've seen big declines in platinum, palladium. Palladium has been all over the map, but we won't go there. But platinum looks like it's trying to base out. The same with gold and silver. They look a little bit early yet for a turn back up, but I think that could be coming, and we could see some resurgence in the precious metals in the weeks ahead. Copper also has pulled back from around 488 at the May highs to around 427. $4 is still critical support for copper, but that looks like you could make a run back towards the mid-May lows and the June 4th lows, right back up around 450, 460. So the copper price seems to be pretty well supported in here and looking like, you know, it's circling the wagons, getting ready for another rally.
You know, as you look at this market, Frank, it's hard to get bearish when you think of the stimulus that's coming into this economy with fiscal spending. Biden is talking about spending $6 trillion. The Fed is still going to be printing $120 billion a month, and that's not going to fall back until maybe next year when they start to taper. So with all that kind of money, I mean, I've never seen this kind of fiscal spending in my lifetime. It's almost insane. It's like we're at war.
It's remarkable, and it really is translating into the stock market, because the money is, I think that's what's creating this massive rotation. We have had the advanced decline line has been moving up now 321 days. I went back through the last 40 years of AD line data, and I found that usually when you get out to around 360, 370 days, that may be where you start to see the internals peak. And then it's a couple months after that before you actually see prices peak. So the way I look at it, this market, yeah, it's possible you could have a mild correction in August, you know, maybe something in the August-September time period, something of 5 to 6%. But I think going into the fall, the market will still be in one piece. And this looks like if we're going to get something, it may be later in the year, maybe very late in the year, like around December. So that would be just kind of putting some normal past cycles onto the current cycle. And I think the thing that's creating and extending this cycle, making it very long, is all that excess liquidity. The money has no place else to go, and it's just forcing its way into equities.
Let's move on to the idea of inflation and interest rates, because we've seen the inflation numbers go up, whether you're looking at PPI, CPI, Housing prices are up double digits year over year. And yet, Frank, we've got the bond market, which peaked in March. We got yields falling. So which is telling the real story? Is the bond market sensing something that we don't see quite yet?
You know, the bond market has been remarkable. If somebody had told me that we would see the kind of surge in inflation that we have seen over the last 3 to 4 months, and that the 10-year bond yield would still be under 175 and not over 2, let alone maybe 3, I would not have believed it. So to me, that's the most amazing part of the entire story, is that bond yields did not explode higher. I was listening to one Fed governor from the Boston Fed last week, who was talking about the difference between the CPE, PCE deflator and the trim mean inflation gauge. And he was saying very confidently he thinks that inflation will mean revert to the downside in the next few months. And I guess perhaps that there's an argument there. But really, bond yields have been incredibly well behaved. They've been incredibly trusting. And when I look at the 10-year at 148 right now, there's very strong resistance at 1.8%. There's very strong support at 1.38%. I think we're going to see a little uptick in yields over the next few weeks towards 170. But I could see later on this year that yields could resume the larger downtrend. I know David Rosenberg and Lacey Hunt, two longtime bond aficionados who have been in the camp of falling interest rates for many, many years. They're looking for yields to dip down later this year. So while I don't fully understand it, I'll be the first one to admit I'm surprised at how well bonds have held up. The price action sort of speaks for itself. And, I think as we turn the page on the calendar year in December, you might be surprised that bonds next year have a much better year than most people would currently think.
You know what really surprises me, Frank? We had the inflation trade going along with the increase in the inflation numbers. So you saw commodities, energy, you saw gold, silver, copper rising along with that, along with cryptocurrencies. Then the Fed has its meeting and says, well, you know, we'll start raising interest rates in 2023, maybe a year earlier. And all of a sudden, everybody flips out of the inflation trade.
That seems to be what happened. The inflation trade has pulled back. But, you know, importantly, most of those assets are still holding solid uptrends. They've gone from overbought to oversold. So there's a pretty good chance here that if yields back up in the next few weeks, I think you'll see another rally in those inflation assets. I think we're moving through this wave of inflation. The market's discounting it in, and those assets in some cases could come back up and retest the highs. I keep a copper mining stock index, and that looks like it's definitely basing and getting ready to try for another rally. I think the next time it does come up, and maybe the same with gold, we'll have to take a closer look because, you know, at that point, there might be more divergence than has been there in the recent past. Usually the divergence is the hint that tells you some kind of larger turn is coming. And we haven't seen that so far. But I think right now the next step in yields is probably a little bit higher. That inflation trade probably catches a little bit of a bid. But all in all, I think this juggling act that we've been in is going to continue to persist for quite some time. And the stock market with group rotation will continue to work its way higher.
Yeah, I could just see the CPI numbers going up, Frank, because when you're talking about oil prices at $75 a barrel, I mean, you think of anything you buy in the store, the gas you put in your tank and how we get goods, they're brought to you by vehicles that use oil. So that's going to pass through eventually.
Yeah, well, I think the risk and what I mean, I went through the conference board this morning and their present situation gauge, the forward expectations gauge, a lot of the surveys that they have that look forward 6 months. By and large, most of those are still in good shape. The labor market, financial prospects, people feel like their incomes are going to go up, that there's, you know, jobs are plentiful. I am starting to notice that we've seen some hit to forward spending plans. And I think if crude oil keeps moving and the gas price moves through, like for example, yesterday I filled up, it was 486 in Torrance. And if that pushes through five, I think that could hit a lot of wallets. It's already hitting wallets. And that can cause, you know, people to cut back. So we've seen that in the past. It's worth recalling that if you go back and you look at the start of every recession in U.S. history, inflation, when inflation was surging, inflation continued to surge 3 to 4 months into the start of the recession. So sometimes really sharp higher inflation can actually induce a slowdown. Right now, I think I completely agree with what we're seeing on our radar in that the economic data looks very, very strong. We're coming off this pandemic shut-in, and growth in the second half of the year can. So I don't think the recession, there's any kind of a slowdown or recession in the immediate future. But if that pain trade gets worse as the year wears on, then maybe something to keep an eye on.
Hey, a bit of advice, if I may. I read this thing called cryptocurrencies, and I bought this thing, Bitcoin. Not sure what it is, but it dropped in half, Frank. What the hell happened?
My 7-year-old son was talking about that, and he's been swapping M&Ms and jelly beans for cryptocurrency. I just look at it, and I have no clue. So I leave it to brighter minds than myself.
Well, it's...
Oh, JP, I don't know what a Bitcoin is. I'm afraid that one has passed me by. So to me, I look at it, it seems like there's a lot of regulatory issues, and I think, I'm too old for this.
Well, it, seriously, though, it looks like a reversal of the inflation trade because you saw the sharp drop in gold, silver, copper, and also the cryptocurrencies. About the only thing that kind of shot up has been energy, which is what we've been seeing so far.
A little more seriously, I will tell you this. It made a classic top. It built a large distribution top. It broke down. We've seen a sort of what looks like a triangle forming. So I think crypto could have one more thrust down, and then maybe it'll have a recovery. But again, it's when I look at the asset, and it's not something I spend a lot of analytic time digging into, I think you have to really know your stuff with that because it's the Wild West and, it's probably, maybe that's the wave of the future, but I also worry a lot about government regulation coming into that space. And also if you read the net, there's a lot of potential, heavy legislation or maybe anti-corruption legislation coming from the Department of Justice on it. So it seems like water that's just fraught with risk. And, to me, good old fashioned gold, I like the sound of gold coins clanking around. And if I have my inflation asset, you give me some gold and silver, I'll be really happy. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, listen, right now you see things in a positive light. The market looks positive. If there was trouble to erupt, where would you expect it to come from, and what would you be looking for?
I would think we would see a deterioration in breadth. I think we have to watch the Delta variant, which has a very high R-naught. It's spreading pretty quickly. It's in many countries, including the United States. A lot of people would say, well, Frank, who cares? A lot of the population is vaccinated. That may be true, but some of the data is showing that the vaccines may not be as robust. There's questions out there I've seen about how long the antibody resistance really does protect from these vaccines. Some suggest that it could wear off in 3 to 5 months. And so if that's the case, and I think the place to watch is the UK, because that's a pretty heavily vaccinated population. And we have been seeing the Delta variant spread there very quickly. That's data that I would be keeping a close watch on as we move forward. Because you see, the problem is if you get back into a large case count, people can get fearful. And these markets are priced up at very high multiples. That's the kind of thing that can create a turn. Right now, I don't see it in the technicals. The technicals still look very strong. We're obviously day to day, week to week, and we're watching it. You know, hands on the tiller. But I think if there's an issue out there, it could be, again, medical. I don't think it would be as bad as last year. It's probably a milder issue if it comes. But that's one area I'm keeping my eye on, JP.
So as we take a look at this, Frank, and close, why don't you tell our listeners about something that you're going to be working on, which is an inflation account, which is multi-assets. In other words, you can go into commodities, you could go into stocks, you could go into foreign currencies. Tell our listeners a little bit about it and its purpose.
Well, it's designed for the long term, because I agree. I think, you know, when you look at the United States with large deficits and a lot of what's happening in the background framework for the dollar is at risk long term from losing its position as the reserve currency. There's actually a lot of discussion about the special drawing rights. And so all of these things, as time goes on, may continue to force money towards inflation protection assets. And this is an area that we know very, very well. It goes far beyond just gold and silver. It includes things like timber, other raw materials, tangible assets, if you will. And so what I'm doing is I'm putting portfolios together. And of course, a common theme in all my work, I really am a portfolio manager that caters to retirees and conservative investors, people who need to earn a return on their money, but who really can't afford to take a lot of risk. And so we use trailing stops on every position. Trailing stops are a beautiful thing. They keep risk under control. I apply them to the positions in the portfolio, and the whole goal is always to keep the drawdown in every portfolio that I manage. We have the tactical income portfolios out there right now, where we tend to focus on high dividend yielding stocks. But the goal is always to keep the drawdowns very small, and so that if there is a drawdown, it's a quick and easy recoverable loss. In this way, people can go to bed, put their head down on the pillow, and have peace of mind and sleep well at night. And so that's really the thrust of everything I do, is always risk mitigation and trying to generate a satisfying return.
So, Frank, if our listeners would like to get in touch with you, tell them how they could do so, please.
Well, they can just give us a call at the office, 858-487-3939, JP, and I'm happy to chat with anyone. Please don't hesitate to call. We love our audience.
And finally, Frank, it's a 4th of July weekend. Any change in your eating plans?
Dieting, Jim, I'm dieting. Trying to get slimmer ahead of this Delta variant. There you go. I probably had too many barbecues. I'm a potato chip away here. I don't want to.
Okay.
Well, I've got to fit in my pants.
Okay. Well, listen, my friend, have a nice, safe 4th weekend.
Okay. Well. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I know the word inflection point has been thrown around so much lately, and we're all sick of hearing it, but this is truly an inflection point. And what's so incredible about this is that we have never experienced anything like this in human history, where the number of aging people, older people, are outnumbering now the number of children as our birth rates decline and as our life expectancy increases.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
West Texas Intermediate crude has hit $75 this week. We're back to the highs that we've seen in 2018. But could it go higher? Could we be getting as high as in the $100 price range? That's what we're going to discuss today, looking at some of the fundamentals and geopolitical factors that are driving the oil market. Jim, what is your analysis on oil prices and where do you see them headed?
You know, Chris, I think that we're going to be crossing triple-digit oil, and we could see that in the next 6 to 12 months. And there are a number of reasons for that. And if you take a look, it probably began somewhere around 2014. If you take a look at the last 7 years, we had the OPEC war in 2014, where Saudi Arabia and a lot of the OPEC producers just produced as much oil as they could, driving the price down from triple digits, and it drove it down to 60. And then we had, of course, what happened last year. I never have seen this in my life. We're actually at one point last February, Chris, we were negative $40 on oil. So if you take a look at a chart of where we've come from oil down to, let's say, even $10 range to where we are today, we've had a significant increase. But here's why I think this is going to happen, because a lot of people were talking about, especially after the pandemic, that we had reached peak demand. Now, remember, in the 00 decade, we were talking about peak oil. Now we're talking about peak demand, because as the economy electrifies and we all start driving EVs, we're not going to need much oil. And I just don't buy that argument. And probably at the top of the list is what has happened to CapEx spending with a lot of these major oil companies, especially with the drop that we saw in the downturn in oil. A lot of companies weren't spending a lot of money. They were reducing their budgets. And obviously, when we got down to $10, $20 oil, you can't make money. I mean, the oil you produce, you're losing money on every barrel that you produce. So a lot of companies just simply cut back production. They also cut back on CapEx spending. And the IEA has been warning for years now that if we don't pick that up, we're going to have some problems by the time we get to mid-decade. There's another factor that's also going in, and it gets in with this kind of green economy that we're moving into, and that's ESG pressure. I mean, it's basically starving the sector for cash. And from Wall Street's perspective, a lot of money went into the shale companies. The shale companies concentrated on production growth, but they didn't make any money. They were losing money. They had negative cash flow. They kept, you know, diluting their stock or adding more debt. So Wall Street just simply got tired of it, walked away from the industry. So now you have a lot of Wall Street money is going into green energy. In fact, on top of that, you have a lot of people on Wall Street that are getting actively involved with oil companies and trying to get them to divest of their assets, which I think is going to be a big mistake that we're going to regret later on. And you even have things like the courts in Belgium that has ordered Royal Dutch Shell that they have to get their carbon footprint down by 2040 or 2050. So there's a lot of pressure on the Western big oil companies to basically divest themselves of oil, Chris, at the time when we're going to start needing oil even more.
You know, Jim, it's interesting. We were talking about on our podcast this week on FS Insider about how we could be looking at double-digit GDP growth rates in the second quarter of this year. We might be looking at peak growth rates in 2021, but clearly there's a lot of demand coming in post the lockdowns. If you would mind, tell us about some of the fundamental supply and demand factors that you're looking at.
Well, if you look at even the last decade and the 00 decade, the biggest demand for energy came from the emerging markets, and that's quite honestly where the majority of the global population resides. So I'm talking about India, I'm talking about Asia, China. And the other thing is, you know, you'll see the experts say, well, you know, demand growth for energy has slowed in the West over the last couple of decades. Well, it really hasn't. What happened is the West outsourced its manufacturing capacities basically to Asia and China. So we saw Chinese oil consumption go up. But, you know, they make the products, but the finished products are sold back to us. So one reason our demand has not been as strong is what has happened to our manufacturing base, which a lot of it, as we found out with the pandemic, went to China. And one of the problems that we're experiencing now, whether it's chip shortages or even during the pandemic when we needed drugs, a lot of the generic drugs and our drugs that we get in the West are manufactured in China. So there was a shortage. And I had a client who has to take medication. And I remember this gentleman said he had to go to like 10 different pharmacies before he could finally get his prescription filled because they were simply out. And the reason given was, hey, it comes from China. The supply chain is disrupted. And we saw a lot of supply chain disruption, which is causing problems for manufacturing here. So, but anyway, if you take a look at the U.S., despite the fact that we have not been growing as much, the U.S. consumes 5 to 6 times the amount of oil per capita as China, and 15 times the per capita consumption of oil is India. So if you look at what's going on globally right now, as China's economy picks up, as Asia starts to come out, the emerging markets are still the number one source of growing oil demand. So there's, and not to mention here, one of the things that really surprised me with COVID is where people spent their money. You talk to a boat dealer, you know, people like Beneteau, they're sold out here until the end of 2022. RV dealerships are selling anything that can come across their lot. People are buying boats, they're buying cars. And I think what you're going to see as we open up, you're going to see more people traveling on the roads during the holidays. It'll be interesting to see what happens to gasoline consumption this summer during the summer driving season. And I just see it, there's going to be a while before you see mass transportation catch up. And so I think people are going to be putting gas in their car. And if you're in California, well, we're pretty close to $5, and we could be at $5 by the end of the summer.
You know, Jim, with all the inflationary pressures that we see currently, and you're given this forecast for triple-digit oil prices, that's only going to further exacerbate some of the inflationary pressures that we already see. I wonder, like you and Frank talked about in the last segment, if we do see too much inflation come through, if that's going to end up being the cure for high oil prices and causing prices to drop back down. I mean, do you see triple-digit oil prices being sustainable for a long time, or is it something you think will probably just briefly get up there and then crash back down?
You know, I think we could be up there, and then we'll probably pull back when the Fed starts to kill the economy, when they begin to raise interest rates. But then by the time we get to the mid-decade, the problem is, Chris, oil is a depleting resource, and these big companies are not replacing their reserves. Not only that, as I mentioned earlier, very hard for the industry to raise capital, unless you're an Exxon or Royal Dutch or a BP. And then the other thing is these ESG policies are demanding a lot of these big companies on the West divest themselves of their assets. Wall Street's getting in. They want companies to conserve capital, buy back stock, raise dividends, and reduce CapEx. The problem is, you know, once you produce a barrel of oil, you have to replace that barrel of oil. And companies simply aren't spending enough money to replace what they're producing. And on top of that, you have this pressure now that's coming from government and from Wall Street, where, you know, you had a small hedge fund that teamed up with CalPERS and BlackRock and put 2 seats on the board of Exxon. And they're urging Exxon to start divesting itself of oil. Now, what makes that an interesting story is since 2014, when a lot of companies pulled back on CapEx spending with the drop in oil, Exxon went the opposite direction. Exxon said, look, we're going to need a lot of oil in the next decade. So Exxon was spending a lot of money on exploration. In 2018, they discovered one of the largest oil deposits off the coast of Ghana. I think it's like 8 billion barrels of oil. But now you've got Wall Street getting involved. And anytime you get Wall Street involved in anything, I don't care if it's mortgages, you know what that led to, the mortgage crisis. Anytime Wall Street gets involved in something, I get a little bit leery because they usually, you know, don't know what they're doing.
What are some of the other macro factors you think also favor this triple digit forecast you're making?
Well, obviously, when the economies are ramping up, we're talking about economic growth rates, Chris, that we probably haven't seen since the early 80s or maybe even the 60s. So, you know, as the economy ramps up at high economic growth rates, we're going to consume more energy. Secondly, you know, we're coming out of COVID. So there's a lot of pent-up demand for travel. We just did a interview that we'll play on Monday with somebody in the cruise industry. Cruise ships are ramping up now. And so a lot of travel demand coming to the airlines. And then also, we're just doing a bunch of policies. We're restricting drilling. We shut down and vetoed the Keystone Pipeline. The problem is it's cheaper to transport oil through a pipeline, and it's more environmental friendly. It costs more to put oil on a train or a truck. So that's going to be driving up the cost. So factor in. And then finally, Chris, I would say one more macro factor is the money supply. I mean, the Fed has goosed the money supply. It's increased by 25% in its effort to fight COVID. So you got rapid money supply, higher economic growth, economies ramping up, and basically some restrictive government policies that are going to restrict drilling for oil, finding oil, basically shutting off a lot of lands to, let's say, oil production. So all of that added together is simply going to drive the price of oil up and put more hands in the power of OPEC.
Yeah, and also if you look at a seasonality chart of crude oil prices, crude oil tends to be at its weakest point in January and February and then climb all the way up until it peaks around August, September. And that's as you get towards the end of the driving season, and then it weakens from there. So it sounds like if you're look at that chart just from an oil seasonality perspective, do you think that that's about when we may end up hitting that triple digit price is as we get towards the end of summer, August, September?
I don't see it coming that soon. I think it's something that's going to play into 2022 and probably towards the latter part of the year. Because if you look at that seasonality, oil starts to ramp up the middle of the summer because we have the summer driving season. People are taking trips in their cars, their RVs, and also getting on airplanes, taking vacations. So that drives energy costs. And then you have the shoulder months in the fall when the weather's nice and you're not consuming as much energy. The kids are back to school, vacation's over, and you usually get, September, October, the price of energy tends to pull back, and then it goes up towards the end of the year as winter comes upon us. But the thing that I'm seeing right now is I'm watching inventories are below their five-year average, and a lot of damage has been done to the industry. A lot of these small stripper wells have been capped. They're not coming back. So recovering demand and lower supplies are going to lead, in my opinion, to an undersupplied oil market. In fact, the IEA just came up, last week or maybe it was earlier this week, they said that non-OPEC production is down about 500,000 barrels a day. And OPEC says we need to start ramping up because if OPEC doesn't switch and start gearing up and putting more oil, then, a lot of this, Chris, is going to be dependent on what OPEC does. If they begin to start increasing their production, it may take a little bit longer. If they don't, it'll come sooner. But right now, global inventories are down about 55 million barrels since May 20th. And you take a look at in the U.S., they're down by 1 million barrels. At the same time, you've got the economy ramping up, and oil production and demand this year is expected to be about 5.5 million barrels more. And so if you take a look at where's that 5.5 million barrels going to come from, it's either going to have to see shale ramp up or OPEC is going to have to go full tilt all out in production. Otherwise, we're going to have a bottleneck here and we could see that triple digit. But right now, global excess oil capacity is going to be gone by probably mid-2022. So there really is no margin for error here, either on the part of shale producers ramping back up or OPEC going back up, because otherwise, it seems to be the story of oil. You go from one extreme where, there's too much oil, they're putting it on ships, they don't have any place to store it, which was pretty much the case for 2020. And then you go in the opposite direction where there's tight bottlenecks. So it always tends to go to extremes on either end, on the plus side or on the downside. The other thing, too, I think playing into this is politics as we try to move towards green energy. The Biden administration, to me, is one of the bullish administrations for oil because they're restricting drilling. They're talking about removal of tax deductions and subsidies and the cancellation of pipeline projects. And then, of course, once again, politically, the ESG fad, which is driving energy investments for green and starving the fossil fuel industry.
Jim, as you mentioned earlier, oil companies are now under pressure to try to conform to this ESG framework, and many are engaging in heavy marketing strategies to try to say that they are moving towards a more environmental way of drilling and producing energy. So, you know, one of these things that we're looking at is a big energy transition here. And as you know, there are forecasts that we'll eventually be moving away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy, solar, wind, and the like. Of course, as you've discussed many, many times on the show, there's no way that we can fully make that transition away from fossil fuels because they do provide that base load power along with nuclear energy, of course. So tell us about your thoughts on the energy transition, how it's playing out now, and where you see these things taking shape in the context of triple-digit oil prices.
Well, if you take a look at energy transitions, I mean, coal replaced wood and, gasoline or oil replaced coal. And then we saw, for example, hydro and natural gas cut into the share of oil. But Chris, historically, each new energy source that comes to play takes market share from the prior one. So a new source gets added onto the previous energy source as you go through this transition. But normally, energy transitions take about 2 to 3 decades. You saw that when we went from horses to the gasoline engine. And, one of the things that nobody's really thinking about, okay, if we're all going to be driving EVs and we're going to be powering these things with charging stations where we place gas stations, you know, where are we going to get the electricity to power these? In other words, what are you going to do to, California's grid, we got power outs here. California shut down its power plants. They're not building any gas plants. And unfortunately, wind and solar is too intermittent. So you're going to need to replace these existing structures with things like a nuclear, or at least have natural gas power plants so that when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine, you've got something that kicks in. Otherwise, you're going to have things like we saw in Texas or the repeated brownouts that we periodically go through here in California whenever you either have real cold weather or warm weather, we get these brownouts. So if we're getting brownouts now, what are you going to do 10 years from now or 20 years from now when everybody has an electric car? Because in my own state of California in 2030, you will no longer be able to buy a brand new gasoline engine car. Everything is going to be electric. My question is, with the new car fleet charging stations, where's the power going to come from? So this is going to take time and more like multi-decade rather than a decade. I think it's a pipe dream to assume that, you know, in 10 years from now, everybody in the country is going to be driving an electric car. Everybody, there'll be charging stations. They'll be ubiquitous like gas stations are today. You know, that whole infrastructure that's going to be needed to put this in place, I just don't see that being done in 10 years.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I'm hedging my bets on this one as well, because I'm both invested in energy producing companies, as well as charging station companies, one of the largest charging station companies that's out there. So, you know, I think obviously we're moving forward with electric vehicles. The Biden administration has definitely been a major tailwind for that. But as you point out, there's also an investment opportunity here for energy, which we've been discussing. So what are some of the investment implications given what we discussed today?
Well, if you look at typical fossil fuel energy companies, your Exxon, Chevron's, energy is definitely out of favor with ESG investing in vogue. That's where capital is being allocated. But, you know, you take a look at the sector, they have great cash flow and dividends. At $75 oil, you're going to see some spectacular earnings come out from some of these companies, whether it's Exxon, ConocoPhillips, Chevron, the majors. The other thing, too, if you want to be a contrary investor, I mean, at one time, the S&P, 12% of the index capitalization was energy companies. Chris, that's fallen below 3%. As of yesterday, the weighting of energy in the S&P was 2.85. The other thing, too, if you look at dividend yields in a world where the 10-year treasury is at 1.5, energy yields are from 5, 7, 8%. So they're grossly undervalued compared to the rest of the market. And at $70 oil, I mean, you know, some of these profit reports that are going to be coming out at the end of the second quarter, which begins this month, as companies start reporting earnings, are going to be very robust and even more so by the time we get to October when they're reporting third quarter earnings, which end in September. So you can't be bullish on the economy when everybody's talking about some of the highest growth rates that we've seen since the 60s or early 80s. You can't be bullish on the economy without being bullish on oil.
So, Jim, if we were to pull out our crystal ball here and summarize some of the things that we discussed, given seasonality, we could probably be looking at higher oil prices into late summer that typically peaks around August, September. So we could be looking at maybe 80 or higher than that. Perhaps we back off around August, September, come back down. And then at that point, it sounds like you're expecting this bullish trend to continue at least until next year when you're eyeing 2022 for triple-digit oil prices. That sound about right, or anything that could go wrong here to derail that outlook?
Yeah, that's pretty much our outlook, and it's the way we're investing. You know, what could go wrong? They put together an Iranian deal. Iran starts pumping a lot more oil, but, you know, even if they pump a lot more oil, I don't think that's going to get rid of some of the bottlenecks I see coming. Or let's say OPEC decides to go in the opposite direction and pump all out. And the other thing is, how fast can shale ramp up? Because I think shale production peaked in 2018. And then, you know, once again, as Frank and I were talking about, the COVID variant and the vaccine rollout. What if that slows out or we get another strain and you get some of these states who are so quick to shut down? It's probably the dumbest thing that we've done is shut down the economy. Because, you know, you take a look at our own state of California, we shut down the economy, people were wearing masks, but that didn't stop the surge in COVID cases last year, which spiked despite all the lockdowns and the mask wearing. So there's always something like that that is out there that could go wrong. Probably, I would say, an outright price war coming from OPEC, shale not being able to ramp up, or, you know, something goes wrong in the economy, because right now you've got the bond market going down. Interest rates, we peaked around 1.75 on the 10-year. We're down below 1.5 now. And so the bond market could be telegraphing, well, maybe down the road we're seeing a slowdown. So there are a number of things that could throw this forecast awry, but I still think that we're more likely to see triple-digit oil.
Well, as always, if you want to speak with any of our investment advisors or wealth managers here at Financial Sense Wealth Management about what we're doing when it comes to the energy space and how we're investing, you can give us a call at 888-486-3939, or you can click Contact Us right off our website, financialsense.com.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we want to wish you a safe and pleasant holiday weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.